hate this bit every time. Episode 12, and I still hate it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 3 of season 2 of Less Talking, More Running, podcast brought to you by Aycliffe Running Club. I didn't say that last time, Paul. I just went straight in.
Missed it.
When I was editing it the other day, I just remembered I didn't actually mention the name of the podcast. So if people are listening to it for the first time, and I'm sure there were a lot, because obviously Kieran and Ben got a big following with North East Project. So they're probably listening and being like, is this definitely the right podcast? But this is definitely Less Talking, More Running. Now, on the last podcast we did with John and Jack from John Flynn Physiotherapy, Paul, what did you make of it? I learned a lot?
I thought it was really interesting. I learned a lot. I learned a lot of the mistakes I normally make of returning from injury too quickly, and picked up a few things I can do to help myself. But it was really interesting. I think it's always interesting when we get experts in. Certainly as a coach and as a member of a running club, I like to feel well informed. So it's nice to get that feedback from them.
Awesome. I don't have any reflection on numbers because I've literally, as we're speaking right now on Monday evening, on the 8th of February, I've only just released it. So I can't get excited over numbers this time. Right. We've got another member of the club joining us this week. And it's a special reason, which I'll let her talk about. But we have Michelle Scott. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, everyone. You all right?
Yeah, not bad yourself?
I'm fine, thank you. Good. Sorry, I always hate my radio voice.
Have you been on the radio before?
Yeah. It's horrible listening back. I'll hate it. But yeah, let's get it done.
Yeah, I hate it every time, isn't it? I'm thinking, just make that sound a bit better. But it is what it is, isn't it?
It is.
So, Michelle, before we introduce the guest, do you want to just a quick run through and what sort of like racing and triathlons you kind of do, just to give a flavour of them if someone outside the club are listening to the first time, kind of who you are?
I started doing pentathlon when I was about 12 years old, and continued it through my military career. And then when I left the army, changed from 5 sports down to 3 and took up triathlon. So I swapped a horse for a bike, much harder on a bike than riding a horse. Well, it depends which horse you get the luck of the draw out of. And obviously dropped shooting and fencing and carried on swimming and running. So I would say it was a little bit easier. Probably just as expensive. But yeah, 3 sports is definitely easier to train for than 5.
I tell you what, I'd love to get you back on to the podcast later on in the year to kind of talk about that a bit more. But unfortunately, fortunately, we've got an absolute superstar on the podcast, don't we, Michelle? I'll let you introduce her.
So there was a bit of a mix up there. I met Sabrina, who is a fantastic runner, back in my military days. For some reason, I thought Sabrina was in the army with me down at Sandhurst, but I've just realised it was an Oxford-Cambridge match at Sandhurst while I was down there training. I probably would have been back in about maybe 2005, and then maybe 2006. I left in 2007, so it's probably around about that range, so a long, long time ago. And then realised that when people were popping up last year saying, this girl's running this amazing event and she's done so well, I was like, oh my God, I know her. I met her a long, long time ago. I'll get in touch and see if she doesn't mind coming joining us at Aycliffe to explain about her experiences. So without further ado, just want to introduce Sabrina Virgie, who's our vet over in Cumbria. And he's on call as well, so tonight. So thank you for coming and doing this.
Oh, I'm glad you're not inducing me. I do that a lot to dogs, you know, put them under anaesthetic.
Told you I'd get nervous.
Right. So thanks for inviting me along, and I'm very happy to chat to you about running things. Love chatting about running. I ditched all 4 of my pentathlon sports for just running. So just one to train for now, which is much easier. And I think that's really a big attraction of running, that you just need a pair of running shoes and there's not all this expensive kit. Although you can accessorize, of course, you can have your Garmin or your Suunto, whatever, your watch and various gubbins. But yes, I think it's a nice, simple, accessible sport that everyone can do.
That's awesome. And I think what you just said there, you've gone from five spots down to one. You've picked that one spot, but you've picked that, as Paul's going to run through some of the races you've done, you've done it probably the harder end of the spectrum in terms of running, haven't you?
Oh, the long stuff.
The long stuff.
Well, it's that's all about your perspective on things, I think. And I noticed that you're going to ask me about my most brutal race. It's probably going to be the shortest ones. So I did a fell race, the Pike of Bliscoe, which is probably only a few kilometres, but it goes up this hill to the summit. I don't know. I should know how high it is, maybe 700 metres or something. It takes about an hour, but it's horribly painful. And I was last. That was our most brutal race I think I've ever done. But I enjoy the long races. I'm better at just going at a slower, steadier pace. Who likes being out of breath and having burning legs? I mean, honestly.
I mean, you mentioned obviously the long distances. I'm just looking back at some of the races you've done. And we've got here, you mentioned you came last there, but you certainly never come last all the time. You've got first woman at the Grand Tour of Skiddaw on several occasions, the first woman in the Cumbrian Weight Ultra on a couple of occasions, I think, first woman at the Lakeland 50, first woman at the Lakeland 100. I mean, these kind of miles must be making your nose bleed, Corey. I mean, Corey, if he goes over 10K, he just, you know, that's it. He can't do over 10K. And obviously we come on to the Dragonback race and the Spine race as well that you've participated in. This is some phenomenal mileage, I have to say.
Yeah, and you know, I always think it's a shame to stop. But the best thing about these really long ultra races is you get to go and explore these amazing areas. So rather than, you know, a 10K road race, which really is just pummeling the tarmac, and personally I don't get great satisfaction out of that, and you've only got one way to go with it, you know, just looking at your watch and hoping that you get faster, and at some point you've got to hit a ceiling because bodies just don't get faster and faster. Whereas with the ultra running, you know, I'm not really ever thinking about exactly how long it's going to take, because these things are largely out of my hands, to be honest, depending on the ground conditions, weather conditions, how hilly the course is, you know. So even running the same course, you know, year after year could be a different time, nothing to do with your performance. So it kind of makes your mind drift from the sort of just trying to grind along as fast as you can, and you open your eyes and you look out and you enjoy the scenery and the company and the mountains and wherever you are, and it's just a fantastic way to explore and to relax and to get to know fellow competitors, because the ultra running world is quite small. Kind of how triathlon started out, you know, when I did triathlon some many moons ago, it was a new sport, and you know, you did get to know everybody. But as time went on, it became very commercial, I found, and people weren't very friendly, actually. And they were just trying to get there, do their sort of event and then leave. And you wouldn't have a cup of tea with anyone or talk to anyone particularly. But with ultra running, everyone, you know, just wants to get to know everyone and chat. And it's such a good, it's a sociable scene. And you share miles together, because you, although you're racing against someone, I will happily, you know, pull up alongside somebody and chat to them for, you know, 10, 20, 30, even 100 miles. You know, the first time I did the Spine in summer, a Dutch guy and I ran most of the race together. And unfortunately, he did pull up, but we probably would have just finished that race together happily, because it was good company.
Does it actually feel like racing then, or does it just feel like you're sharing the experience?
It's both. It's everything. Because there are times, yes, when I'm focusing and I'm thinking, I'm going to push hard. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get there that bit faster. I'm going to do this section this way. And yeah, you want to do it as well as you can. But equally, I want to enjoy it. So I want the experience. I don't want to grind and grunt and, you know, sweat. And well, obviously you sweat, but you know, burn and it to be a miserable experience. It's got to be enjoyable, especially if you're spending 4 or 5 days doing it. You know, you've got to want to do it and enjoy it. Indeed. And have something to say for yourself afterwards, I think.
Very much so, very much so. You've mentioned obviously the scenery and you know, sort of like, you know, enjoying it. I was just wondering whether or not, you know, you would want to do any of the big American races, such as the Badwater or the Western States, because I know most of them are road races, I think, aren't they? But would they not appeal to you then?
No.
No.
I couldn't honestly see the point. And some of those larger races, the more commercial ones, I did go and do the UTMB, which I guess when I got into the ultra, that Grand Tour of Skiddaw was my first ever ultra, actually. And then from there, people would be going on about the UTMB, and I thought, well, it's obviously the next thing to do. So there I entered lots of races and got all my points in 3 months, which was quite quick. And then I got myself into the UTMB. And I did actually get an elite start on that. So, but it's bigger. You know, I think there's 2,000 people more. I'm actually not sure how many people go, but it's big compared to our sort of smaller spine races here. And I really felt actually quite overwhelmed by the number of people. And I didn't find it what I wanted. Whereas the Dragon's Back, I lose myself in the hills and the quietude, and you really are alone for large periods of time. On the UTMB, you'd just be middle of the night and there's someone ringing cowbells and you're like, this is a disaster. You've ruined my mountains and it's noisy and it's horrible. And then, you know, the towns are light with loads of people, which probably is fantastic for some people. But I was just like, no, I don't want 1,000 people shouting at me. It's horrible. So it's, I think anything large and commercial, I just wouldn't enjoy and I'd shy away from, to be honest. It's not my cup of tea. I don't like the mountains being noisy. For me, it's all about peace and quietude. Just run along with a few other runners. And yeah, losing yourself in the hills. So
sounds, yeah, very idyllic.
It is idyllic. It's wonderful, and you get to eat loads of food. I mean, I haven't mentioned the food yet. I always tell people it's like a walking picnic or a running picnic, and it's all going to go wrong. Don't stuff your face, basically.
That was our next question, actually, wasn't it? About like, how do you fuel yourself for a race, and how has that changed over the years?
Yeah. How's it changed? I've always been one for proper food, to be fair. Now, it's not always convenient to take proper food, like trying to eat a full-on sandwich while you're running along, but I have perfected the art. I think I can eat most things while running, a burger and chips, you know, whatever's going, throw it at me, I'll have it. Cake's my favourite.
Corey suddenly perked up there when you mentioned burger and chips and cake. You know,
ultra running, I might get into it now.
When I did swim run once, Kendall mint cake was the best thing that perked me up at the, just as I was about to climb up one of the mountains. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not my cup of tea, but proper cake, you know, like baker cake, like a Victoria sponge with buttercream or something.
Stodgy cake. Oh, yeah.
Like full of calories, all the stuff that you'd probably be telling yourself normally that you shouldn't eat loads of. The great thing, you should eat as much as you can fit in. I'm quite an anti-gel person because I just think they don't really work for long races, you know, because you're just giving yourself a sugar hit and you'll feel great for about 5 minutes and then you'll just hit the deck and feel rubbish. So if you try to race an ultra race on that, not only will you just be up and down like a complete yo-yo, but you'll actually tear up your insides because that much sugar on an empty stomach is just going to destroy you and you'll end up with gastric ulcers. And I have seen it a lot in a lot of male runners doing that, just banging in the gels. But I have also noticed and taken note that it can help you through a bad patch. So if you can't eat solids, at a particular point in the race, but you should be trying to eat solids, then, you know, you can pop a gel in and it can sort you out for a short period of time while you then work up the capacity to start eating again. But really at that point, it's all gone a bit wrong if you've got to the point where you can't eat. Because if you can't, you know, the only thing that stops you from being able to run further and faster is fuel. It's like a car running out of petrol, diesel. So if you don't put any in, you get nothing out. And while you might be able to roll down the hills on an empty tank for a bit, you really can't go very far. So you do just have to get something in. As I say, I'll occasionally use a gel just to bounce back from an accident if I've missed, messed up my feeding regime for whatever reason. But I like proper food. Bananas are really good.
I've heard that flapjacks are the food of choice of ultra runners.
Brilliant. Brownies. Did I say cake? Have I mentioned that?
You may have mentioned cake, yes.
Chips, potatoes in any form with lots of salt on. Ketchup, mayonnaise to make them a bit gooey because you get a bit dry. You know, the longer you run, you do get a bit of a dry mouth. And something people won't be aware of until they've raced for over 24 hours, but you can get mouth ulcers quite easily from the types of food, but also it's probably the fact that you are constantly eating, like every hour for that long, your mouth never gets a break from the food. And so really high sugar foods or spicy foods might cause ulceration early. And that's pretty sore and a bit painful and obviously going to be a reason why you stop eating, and then it's all going to go downhill from there. So you want to look after your mouth in these really long, long things. If you're doing 3-4 days of constant eating, for example, the Wainwrights, you know, you had to be really careful what foods I ate. So some lovely people would come along with something they thought was delicious, but if it had a load of chili in it, I'd be like, that's not happening. and not to eat too much just raw sugar. So like sweeties with, you know, for example, probably the worst thing you could eat would be one of those sour type sweets.
Haribos really, or something like that.
It's really yummy, but after a few days that will really sting. And then you can get swollen tongue, swollen mouth, and it's pretty unpleasant. So those are things to avoid.
What goes into the fueling strategy in terms of timing? Because I imagine once you start to feel a little bit hungry, you might be a bit too late, and that's when you start going downhill. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Once if you go too long without food, you've got to imagine that your blood supply is all going to your legs and muscles to keep you moving. So it is going away from your stomach to digest, especially the harder and faster you run, the less your digestive system is working. It's all switching off because you're sending your energy to go elsewhere. And so that is part of the problem, is running too hard to allow your body to digest food. There has been some calculations somewhere once upon a time, it was back in my adventure racing days, and I've hung on to it ever since, of 300 calories an hour is the amount apparently your body can process while you are running. So there isn't much point eating too much more than that, but that probably is the minimum also that you want to get in. So it works out about, you know, a typical chocolate bar, energy bar, sort of amount of food every hour. And so that's what I try and do. I try and eat that much every hour, but I'm not so good at eating large amounts in one go. So I probably break it up into half hour. So I probably have half a bar every half hour. But obviously it's not bars, so it might be chips or burgers, which I do feel very sorry for some of my Wainwright supporters who had to carry a burger around for about 4 hours of a leg while I was eating it. My chips that were very cold, which I would eat like, I don't know, a chip every 5 minutes. But
oh my God, yeah. That's so fascinating. And would you find yourself that you choose when to eat? Is it perhaps like more likely like when you're going uphill, when it might be your slower moments, or is it not? But is it more specific to time?
No, you're absolutely right. I prefer to eat while I'm going uphill. So if I'm going up a hill that's steep enough that I'm walking, which is, to be fair, most of them, then that's much easier to take food on board, because you're not worrying about tripping over, for starters. You know, going downhill trying to eat, you fall over your own feet if you're not careful, or you'll drop your chips, and that's terrible. So while you're going uphill and walking and not jiggling your poor stomach up and down, it's easier to take food in, and you can naturally drop down to a slightly more relaxed pace, which drops your heart rate a little bit, which then allows your blood to flow to your stomach, and then you can start digesting it. You know, and the hills and the lakes, obviously some of them are taking 40 minutes an hour to climb, so that's plenty of time to allow digestion to happen. And that means then probably some point, and the other thing you might want to do though on that note is, if you're going to go up a steep climb and you need some more energy, you could then put in a gel to get you that sugar to allow you to climb as well. It's another good strategy for certain parts of courses and things, if you're going to get to something steep, to bung in a gel to give your legs the extra go power. But yeah, no, so I prefer eating uphill, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of things do you drink? Do you just drink plain water, or do you add anything in to, like, salts and stuff? Or
so, yeah, it's really important to get the salts in. And obviously, the hotter it is, the more important that is. So I'll put either electrolyte tabs in the water. I'll also have salt capsules if I've got to the point where I don't want to drink flavoured water. I like tea. I drink a lot of tea, and I normally like my tea strong with very little milk in it and no sugar. But when I'm running, I have the opposite. I have horribly weak, milky, gross looking tea with about 3 sugars in it. And it's, I wouldn't have that normally, but while I'm running, it's fantastic because it's exactly what you want. And a little bit of caffeine as well, because I'm generally quite sleep deprived, is quite useful. I also drink, I use Mountain Fuel a lot. They have a raw flavor, which is flavorless, and that's really good, because if you get sick of the sugary taste, you can have the raw flavor, and I found I can take that quite well for days on end. And the other thing I really like that they do is the recovery fuel. They've got strawberry and chocolate flavor, and oh my god, the chocolate, you would drink it like it's a milkshake. And I also hot chocolate with it, which I'll also have if it's cold when I'm racing, and it's absolutely brilliant. But I also feel that's a good way to get protein in, because while you might do a 3-hour race and then have a protein shake after, if you're doing 5, 6, 7 days of running, you need to put the protein back in while you're still running, and that is a really good way to do it. So yeah, I do that. I'm trying to think what else I drink. I quite like the odd Lucozade as well. But yeah, a lot of water, straight water as well, in between, to kind of wash your mouth out so that you've got a sort of, I might brush my teeth occasionally on these things, water for a bit, just to try and give my poor mouth a break.
So far I've heard burger, chips, cake, chocolate.
Where do you get one of these?
Yeah, where do you get all these entry forms for these races? It's we've obviously spoken about fueling and fueling strategies. What about mental strategies? Do you have anything that you use yourself, as in a mantra or something along those lines, to push you on? Or are you enjoying it so much you don't feel the need? Or
I get asked this all the time, and I have to say that maybe I have a screw loose or something, because people are doing it who shouldn't be doing it. I don't know. But if I needed something to keep me going all the time and make me do it all the time, I probably wouldn't do it. You know, if I don't like doing something, I just don't do it. So, you know, people always tell me I should do some hill sprints, so because I complain that I'm slow uphill compared to my downhill speed. And they're like, well, you need to do hill sprints. And I'm like, that would be so boring and painful, so I'm not going to do that. Basically, just not going to do it. So I definitely don't want people to think that and I hope it's not the same the case for lots of other people who run these ultras, but I don't want people to think that I'm doing these brutal races that are really hard and horrible and I'm having a terrible time and I have to make myself keep going, because it's just not the case. Generally, I would need to be stopped, you know, you'd physically need to stop me and say no, no more for me, you know, rather than the other way around, because I want to be there. I want to do it. I'm generally having a good time. Yes, of course, there are times when, you know, something hurts or, you know, you probably feel like having a sit down. And I guess if that's the case, sometimes I do just need a sit down. You know, if you've been going for 24 hours and like something's, you know, giving up on you, then sometimes that's your body just saying, look, just need a bit of time out here. And then you can maybe have a sleep for an hour, get your body horizontal, feeling good again, eat some food, and then you get up and you feel good again and ready to go. But of course, you ultimately need the motivation and the desire and the enjoyment of doing these things. And that comes, you know, that's a bit of a vicious cycle, really, because that also comes with training and, you know, teaching your body to do it so it is comfortable. Because I do think a lot of people go, oh, I'm just going to enter the spine race, having not done anything like it at all, and then they do it, and honestly, these people are just putting themselves through this massive suffer fest, which may be the attraction, I have really no idea. Worst thing is their feet, and you're like, how are you even moving on feet that look like that? And I'm just like, I just can't believe it. And you know, it's taken them two or three times as long as it has for me to do it, and they end up in such a mess. But they enjoy it in their own little way. But I do think they need a mantra to keep themselves going. But I would say the better way around is to get your body ready for these things. You know, do, if you can't run 10, 20K a day, then really entering something like the spine or the dragon's back is a very stupid idea, because your body is just going to be very unhappy because it's going to do it. And your poor feet will not be used to like running every day, and you'll get blisters. And blisters are extremely painful. But if you train your feet and learn what shoes and socks you need, and you're actually running, remember, when you run versus when you walk, your feet are actually touching the ground less. So I think that is a reason why people who are walking these things get more blisters than if you're running. So all of these things help to make it a more comfortable experience. And I do think comfort's important. So comfort in your physique, in your physical ability, and comfort in your equipment, and knowing what equipment you need to keep yourself comfortable, and knowing what clothing you need to keep yourself warm and dry and all these things, or not too hot, all comes with experience. So I would say if you're going along to these ultras and you're grinding away and it's a massive surfer fest, then there's something wrong.
You've just described like at least a handful of my friends.
I've
entered the spine race and have complained about exactly those things. So that's brilliant. I hope I will send this to them to make sure they're
finished. Well, I hope I can help people. I have a little kit review page on Facebook. And I occasionally just put some banter about a piece of kit that I think is brilliant. But if people have any specific questions about something, they always post something on there, and then I'm happy to answer it. If I can make your running lives more comfortable, I'm very happy to have a smile on your face instead of a grimace. It makes it a lot better.
So you obviously mentioned about you know, preparing yourself for the race. What does your normal training week or training month look like then?
So my job's a bit erratic. I work days and nights. So I don't have much control about when I can go and do stuff. I do have dedicated days off, and then they're my definite long running days. However, they often follow a night on call, and that night on call can be doing nothing, but all that night on call can be up all night with surgery and then looking after a patient afterwards. So yeah, last Thursday night was an all nighter, and I planned to go running with a friend Friday morning. And I'm glad I planned to meet him, because I was like, right, otherwise I might have just gone to bed. And we went out running, and it was brilliant. And it was a great way to unwind. But that's what I do a lot. Everything, I'm a bit erratic with what I do, and I wouldn't call it training because I never write myself a training program because I couldn't stick to it because my life is not routine. And I use my running to relax. It's not my be all end all. If I do great in races, that's great, but I'm not going to beat myself up if I don't make something or do something, because sometimes life's just out of your control. And I'm doing this to make, to mentally unwind, keep my mind healthy and my body healthy, and for enjoyment. And it's also very social. So I'm not a good example to follow with a training regime. I mean, if people look at my Strava and tried to follow it, I would feel very sorry for them, because it doesn't make any sense. There's no rhyme or reason. It's just when I have been available. And if I have all day free, I'll often run. I mean, my favorite thing is to go running all day in the mountains. So if I can, I do. But equally, I'm quite sensible about the weather. So of late, it has been quite cold and icy and a lot of snow in the Lake District. So I haven't gone up too high. And I've done flatter runs that are a bit longer, probably got a bit of road in it. But in the Lake District, nothing's truly flat. Although I would call it a flat run, we did, you know, the run I did on yesterday was sort of almost 40K, and I call it flat, but it had 1,000 meters of elevation, so perhaps flat.
Nosebleed, Corey, nosebleed. Oh, we can't talk about that kind of elevation. No.
It's a different world to me.
Flat as I can get around here, I think, with that sort of distance. So I never make myself go out and do stuff either. So if I wake up and I'm tired and my body doesn't feel like it, then I don't beat myself up about it. And I just go, okay, it's not today. Today's not the day. We're just going to sit and watch TV and eat cake. And that's fine. And I don't get annoyed about it. I just go, oh, well. And then normally it's my body telling me I've probably done too much in the last week or two, and I need to have a break. And I think the worst thing I could do in this situation is kick myself out the door, have a really rubbish session, beat myself up some more because I'm not fast enough, and then be all depressed about it. It's not healthy. You want to enjoy running, and in order to do that, you need to rest as well as you as well as you train, if you train. So yeah, sorry, no training program.
Is that
it's
always
amazingly
been
refreshing? Yeah, to hear that, it's amazingly refreshing to hear that you don't beat yourself up about missing a run or missing a couple of days or anything like that. It's fantastic, I think.
It is. It's quite refreshing. Has that always been the case though? Has it always been about listening to your body, or maybe when you're a bit younger and a bit naive, you thought, I've got this certain training schedule to stick to if I want to just get through a race, for example?
I think the only time I've done a strict training regime was when I was rowing for the lightweights. I was at Oxford, and I joined the lightweight squad, not for a hugely long time, but that was a bit of a blast. It was amazing. I really enjoyed it. We did 13 training sessions a week, designed by a coach, and it worked extremely well, and I got extremely fit. I mean, we did 2 weight sessions. We did a running session, and then a lot of it was rowing. We did a bit of erging, and I stuck to it religiously. And then, yeah, I wouldn't feel like it sometimes. But once I got into it, it was fine. And that did work really well. But I don't feel that was doable because I was at university and larking around and didn't have a job, or anything serious. And I probably did put my sport first at that stage, because that wasn't my veterinary course. Actually, I did another degree first called human sciences, and yeah, it was good. But I would say that I had a lot of spare time, and I definitely put my rowing ahead of everything else. And I'm not in a position to do that now. You know, I'm not a professional runner. Yes, I seem to do okay, but I'm a vet. That's my job. I've got to be focused at work. If an animal has an emergency, then that's more important than me going for a run the next day. So, you know, all of my running plans can get canned at the drop of a hat. So I wouldn't want to put too much effort into writing myself a program that could just go down the toilet. And I think life's like that for a lot of people. You know, if you've got kids, your life must be up and down like a yo-yo as well.
Yeah, I'm just doing the podcast.
We'll have to keep that in, Corey. We'll have to keep that in, mate.
Did I not mute my mic? I thought I muted my mic there.
No.
Okay. That's getting taken out.
That's exactly what Sabrina's just been saying. Life is not a strict plan.
I think actually that's perfect
timing.
That, you know, it's like, yeah, your podcast has a little hiccup in. It doesn't matter.
I know. Sometimes I'm a bit of a perfectionist. No, Mum, I'm not hungry. I'll have it later, okay?
That's come true with me as well. And the older I've got, the more I've learned to go with the flow of things. I think from me being an elite pentathlete, I was constantly 5 sports every day, training full time, coaches, nutritionists, everybody in your ear. You followed your program. You didn't dare veer off. You did as you were told, and you got results. And then leaving that full time training career to then actually have to do a job, but then still try and train full time. I thought I could do that. At the age of 21, that was maybe all right. But as I've got older, that just doesn't happen. And it kind of, you're making a living through your career now, not through your sport. Yes. So it's your job that has to come first. And I feel as I've got older, I actually enjoy what I'm doing more. And actually, the more I enjoy it, the more success that I feel like I have within myself personally. I'm not bothered about my results anymore. As long as I've enjoyed myself, that's all that matters. I mean, I'll still try my hardest and give 110%, but if I don't win, I don't win. It is, I think, as you get older and have that experience as well, I think definitely.
Yeah, it's a bit really life nice to hear that. Definitely life experience. And I was going to say, actually, I think that I hadn't seen you, spoken to you for a long time, and back my memory of you is that you're quite serious. And now you seem a lot more relaxed and cheery and happy, and I think that's a good thing. And I think that there's more to life than winning races. You have to enjoy the process of getting there and being there, because ultimately these things are supposed to make you happy, surely.
Indeed. It's just that that Olympic program, and then you don't make it and you think it's the end of the world, and then you don't know what to do with yourself anymore, and it's like, I have to focus on a career now that doesn't involve sport so much. And I think even in my job, I speak to people who are passionate about stuff every day, triathlon every day, it's their passion, it's their release, and I get it now, I think. But it's really nice and refreshing to hear somebody who's still performing in such a high level enjoys it so much, and it's not your main focus. It's really nice to hear.
So what's your favorite race, Sabrina, that you've done? If you talk about enjoying it, what would be your race that you'd go back to every year? Or
I love so much of them. The spine is so addictive. Like, I don't know why, because I didn't actually want to do the winter spine race so much. I wanted to do the summer spine, because I thought I like it when it's sunny. I like to be able to see stuff, and it's brilliant. I would say definitely the summer spine every time over the winter spine. But there's just something addictive about the whole spine, call it the spine family. You know, these checkpoints that you come into and just see these people, and they feed you, and obviously that's all you really want in life at that point.
Yes.
It's just this amazing experience, and you're in this little bubble for 4 or 5 days where, you know, you have no laptop, no phone, there's no work, you're completely switched off from everything other than the basic raw need to get from A to B, and, you know, the process of just navigating and feeding yourself in order to do that. And similarly, I also love the Dragon's Back. I've done that now 3 times, and the scenery never fails to amaze me. We have also had, the 3 years I did it, amazing weather. If I got a minging year where it just rained the whole time, I might not want to do it so much. So those races are great. I like the longer ones. I like the sort of expedition feel to it, the going from A to B. Those are the ones I really enjoy.
I know that we haven't got this question in our list, but if you were a newbie starting out, which race would you recommend?
So a newbie who's done how much distance?
So if somebody was wanting to do their first ultra and they'd been training for that, what would be a good race around here locally?
Oh, locally to you?
Oh, well, Cumbria is local to us, I suppose.
Okay, yeah. So Cumbria. So you mentioned that I'd done the Cumbrian Way, and I think that's a really good one. It's that one's 72 miles, so that's quite long. But they do also the last bit, which I think is only 30 miles from Keswick to Carlisle. And the reason why I say the Cumbrian Way is because nothing's too technical and it's on a long distance path, you know, like it's not so well marked, but I think they're looking at improving it. But you can use a GPX watch or whatever, but it's not too technical. It's really pretty, obviously goes through the Lake District. That's a good one. The Grand Tour of Skiddaw is also quite good. There's not too much elevation in that, but enough to break up the tediosity of just going flat. Because although it takes longer to go over hills, you know, for the same distance, it actually feels better because your body gets to use different muscles. So rather than repetitively running tuk-tuk-tuk along a road, you know, you've got different terrains, so your feet in all different positions, and you're going uphill, downhill, flat, and that changes throughout a race. So it feels a bit easier on the body. But equally, you don't want to go to one of those races where you're literally ploughing through bog and mud, because I think that's really off-putting. And that's not what it's about. It's not a mud fest. It's supposed to be an enjoyable, scenic route. Mm-hmm. The Lakeland 50 is good for a shorter one as well. And I did another one, a local one, the Lakes Five Passes, I think it's called, which is a bit shorter, 35 miles, I want to say. But that was good and really pretty. So you got to see quite a nice part of the Lake District. So those slightly shorter ones in the lakes are good. And I did one further afield called the Calderdale Hike, I think it's called.
Home Firth Way.
Yeah. I it's not local to me, so I'm not going to pretend I know. but that's a bit shorter as well. And then the other one I really like is the Fellsman, but that's 60 something miles, I think. Mm-hmm. But that's a linear route as well, which I love. But it's also super cheap. I think it's like £15 or something. Mm-hmm. So it's an absolute bargain. and it's, I think it's there for walkers as well as runners. Yeah. So there's no pressure on time, really good feed stations, really lovely route. So that's another really good one to go for. Yeah.
I did once do the Lakeland 15K. That was probably my my limit. But it was a lovely run, I have to say. I think locally to ourselves, I think you'd maybe look at the Hardmoors series. John and Shirley Steele run, yeah, around the North Yorkshire Moors. I think they go up to, I think they've done a 160-mile route they've got. And I think they did the Ring of Steel, which I think was 200-mile for their celebratory 10th anniversary, I think. So there are some ultras around, obviously, the Northeast as well. But, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely need to get on with the Hardmoors. Yeah. Very cool.
So just flipping that then, what would be some of the toughest races you've kind of taken on?
Well, everyone will talk about the Winter Spine as being the Britain's most brutal race. you know, I'm going to agree at this moment in time because it did actually take a lot out of me, but possibly because I wasn't as fit as I would have been going into it, and I probably should have been a DNS, a do not start. but I was too stubborn and I didn't want to be a DNF either, so I just dragged myself to the end. But it was a really wet year, and everything was so muddy. Your feet were just getting pulled apart and ankles, your feet were getting sucked up in the mud every step, and it just pulled on all the tendons and everything. And I honestly, every person that crossed that finish line had tendonitis, and tendonitis is extremely painful.
Yeah.
So it was uncomfortable. a bit hobbly. I think I'd also annoyingly recce'd a particular part of the route up to Cauldron Snout the weekend before and managed to trap my foot in between a couple of stones, and I'd bruised it quite badly. And it had swollen a lot and then all gone down. I thought at the start of the race it was actually fine. But of course, I didn't know what I'd have fell over at some point and sprained that ankle, and it flared up so much. I think because it already had been injured and I couldn't fit my foot in the shoe. It was causing me all sorts of problems. So yeah, for me, that particular race was a bit brutal. And it was really cold at points. When I went over Cross Fell, it was snowing. And if you looked at us, we looked like part of the landscape because we'd just been snowed in. So cold, and we were like frozen. I was really glad I was with a nice chap called Simon Gathella at the time. And I'm so glad we weren't, neither of us were alone, because it was pretty miserable. I was pretty like type two fun, if you've ever heard the expression. And all I could think was just getting to Greg's hut and defrosting myself out of this frozen position. It was so slow, and you couldn't, because so fortunately you'd think, well, people had gone ahead, there were a few runners ahead, so it would normally be a bit easier to follow their footprints, but it hadn't been, it snowed so much that their footprints had been completely covered. So we were treading fresh snow on a path. You couldn't see the path. You couldn't see anyway, because there's snow everywhere. And every other step you're landing it, you know, you're stepping through ice into ice cold water. It was hard. That was hard. And I'm not going to lie about it. And at times it was pretty like, crikey, what are we doing to ourselves? But you get over it. It's not forever. You know, it was maybe 3 hours of that, and then into Greg's hut, and then warming up, and then obviously having to get back out in it and descend. But then back down in Garrigill, it's a lot warmer down in the valley. So, yeah, that's quite a brutal race and aptly named.
Have you ever got lost on any race, even just temporarily?
Of course. I've managed to get lost in virtually my back garden at Cosney 100. Why does that always happen when you should know exactly where you are? So this is the end of the Lakeland 100, I think, when I was ahead of Ken Souter, and everyone was hoping there would be this overall female winner. I got quite a good lead, actually. And then what do I go and do? I wandered off the wrong way. Just not thinking. There was just a split in the path, and I wandered along so much. And then I was just like, oh, yeah. And now this doesn't go anywhere, this path. So I had to retrace my steps, and then just as I got back onto the correct path, there Ken passed me. it was just all a bit too much. Spine's a classic one, because you're quite sleep deprived. You do all sorts of stupid navigation. So in the summer race, I was leading at this point as well. I did win that overall, but I was very much alone. There was no one around. I'd been running with that chap, the Dutch guy, Case, and he'd dropped out, and I'd continued. And I remember going through all these tricky fields and things, and I remember just staring at this thing in the ground, which was a yellow piece of pipe just in the middle of nowhere, and you're thinking, well, what is that doing there? Anyway, I carry on my merry way, and then some hour or maybe 2 hours later, I saw it again. And I stood there for a good moment thinking, this is weird. Why are all these yellow piping things in the middle of it? Very strange. And then I thought, oh no. Somewhere I have turned around and gone back where I was going. And what had happened at some point, I think I had fallen asleep on my feet, done a little 180 turn, merrily followed my GPX watch line, which is just a line, so I followed it perfectly back the wrong way, until I'd got to this yellow pipe and gone, oh no. And then I'd had to turn around again and go the right way. And when I got to the, I wasn't far from the checkpoint either. They were just all there going, what were you doing? And I was just like, yeah, made a bit of an error.
I think you explained that I was expecting you to say you were hallucinating and there was your pipes popping up in the floor. I wasn't expecting that to come turned around and walk back.
This is the problem, and your brain is doing all sorts of crazy stuff as well, so you don't really know. And the other thing I did on the winter spine last year was I literally was going along, and then I just woke up on my feet with my hands in the position of like I was holding a map and looking at a map, but there was no map there. So when I come to you and I'm like, okay, I am standing here with no map. So obviously I needed the map at this point, but I have no map. Then I'm thinking maybe I just dropped the map. So I turned around and had a look for the map. The map was not there. So then I was just like, okay, so now I don't know where I am and I don't have a map. Like, okay. And then luckily I was actually on a track, and I thought, well, I'm just going to follow this track. And luckily I was very near the next checkpoint, like only 3 kilometers of fire road downhill. Otherwise this would have been a lost cause. So I got into that checkpoint and I said to them, I've lost my map. Luckily I managed to borrow one. Anyway, the interesting story was, is that the chap behind me picked up my map.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and I was very glad to be reunited with this particular map after the race. I got it posted back to me by a lovely doctor called George, who posted it back to me. So I was reunited with this map. But yes, your mind is doing all sorts. You're very, very tired, and you can make gargantuan mistakes. And in my adventure racing days, I have done much more hideous mistakes. I mean, I remember paddling in a canoe 10 kilometers past this checkpoint into a headwind, because we just got into this drive of, we have to, you know, we were literally going, right, paddle like this, shouting at each other to try and keep each other awake, so much so we'd forgotten that we were trying to get somewhere. At some point I was just like, where was this checkpoint again? And then we looked at the map, and you just have to turn around, do 4 hours back the direction you came. It's just not funny.
But I can so relate to that. I did my first ever kind of long race, my swim run race, a couple of years ago now. And we were about 8 hours in, and my swim run partner said to me, just think of a song to keep us going. Well, I couldn't think of a song apart from, I know a song that'll get on your nerves. And all he could think of was Happy Birthday. So we were singing that, walking up the side of a mountain. It's so strange when your brain just can't function with the rest of your body.
That's got to be that you must have got too cold at some point. Do you think that's
swim run? Yeah, it was hailstoning on us. And we're in a wetsuit with the swim hat on, the goggles over my eyes while I'm walking, because it was hailstoning that heavy that I thought, well, the goggles will give my eyes
save your eyes a bit of warmth.
I've just got I've got one question. I think do you think that the current situation has led to an increase in popularity in terms of challenging runs or challenging experiences? I'm just thinking, we've not seen probably as much in terms of publicity around attempts at, is it fastest known times that you're seeing these days, such as like John Kelly and Damien Hall on the Pennine Way, and obviously the Bob Graham Round, people are having a crack at that, and Killian John has had a crack at that a couple of years ago, didn't he? But there just seems to be a lot more focus on these races now than there has been previously. Do you get that impression at all or not?
Yes, people are desperate to challenge themselves and they can't go out racing, so mm-hmm. you have to do these challenges that you make up. So I think people have looked at, what's the fastest time anyone's done this, and then they can try and beat it, or they try and find a new challenge altogether and be the first person to do this particular thing. But it's quite funny, there's quite a lot of that. And that with the Wainwrights, I'd wanted to do that for a long time. So when Steve Birkinshaw did it, I from that day I was like, this is one for me. And it took me 6-7 years to crack on with it. And now people have been looking for this winter to do the winter Wainwrights because that's not been done yet. And it does make me laugh a little because the winter conditions in the Lake District are, you know, can be extremely brutal. And the Wainwrights itself is a pretty decent, tough challenge as it is in summer. And knowing that the spine takes in winter, you know, for me, almost twice as long to compete it as it does in summer, you sort of think, and the spine doesn't go up to the heights that the Wainwrights does and doesn't stay very high for very long. You just think some of these people have gone a bit cuckoo. and I don't think they realise that. I think a winter Wainwrights would take minimum 10 days, but realistically probably 14 days. And some of those days you would just have to sit out because the conditions are too brutal to even be on the hill in the lakes. And it's just not safe. But luckily no one has sent themselves out this year. Someone tried last year, but some of these challenges are really good. But I do think that probably we need to save them for the summer, especially if you want the fastest time.
Well, last year, Sabrina, you completed the Wainwrights in 6 days, 17 hours and 51 minutes, which was the third fastest known time for the course and also the fastest women's. But I read an article and you stated that it should not be considered as a record. Am I right in saying that?
Yep, absolutely. And I think I'm probably more famous for writing that little snippet than I've ever done in my life. It was something I just had to get off my chest. Yes, I did the Wainwrights challenge, and it was a personal challenge, and my challenge was to do it in under 6 days. That was my challenge. That still is my challenge. So either way, I didn't do what I was setting out to do, but I had invested a lot of time and effort into getting round. You know, I'd done 4 days worth, and then I really did have quite a bad injury. It didn't fall or anything. It was one of those kind of strange sprains that ended up with me not being able to bend my leg. So quite critical, really. But I wanted to complete the round. I just wanted to finish, go to all the summits. And I thought I probably could still do that in my state. And I did. I really needed some assistance to get down the hills. It was all right going up. But if you've got this useless limb that is actually just getting in the way and will drag and trip on rocks and stuff rather down really steep stuff, I needed to lean on people to get it out of the way, to be honest. It was a bit like that, and I'm not exaggerating. It was at times probably excruciatingly painful for people to watch me in the state that I was, my support team. I had to cling on to them like crutches to get myself down towards the end. And this is physical assistance, really. Not like I was being dragged up the hill or anything like that. And it wouldn't be a way to get the fastest time. You know, you're always fastest at running on your own. Everyone knows that. I didn't feel that it should be counted as a record because of the amount I lent on people. It was long periods of time. Some of these descents took hours, and I might have lent on some for 20, 30 minutes. So it's not like I just had a little handhold or whatever. They were crutches, literally. So for that reason, I just wanted to be straight that it wasn't going to be a record. Now, it wasn't so important because there hadn't been another woman that had done it. I wasn't nicking a title off anybody. So, but what I felt was that someone else might come along, maybe do it in, let's say, 7 days without the assistance. And I didn't want them to feel that they couldn't then claim this record. I wanted it to be unclaimed at that stage. And, I can go and do it another time. That's no bother to me. But I was very happy to complete it. And I've done all the summits and I'm very happy with myself. You know, it was personal satisfaction. And I'm fine with the way that I did it. but it just wouldn't be the way that I would claim a record. So I'm going to go for it again, And when I do, I won't be leaning on anyone because I won't have injury, because I won't continue again with an injury, because my point. The first time you do it, yes, okay, you're just trying to complete it, hobble around, finish, fine. But I really do want to firstly complete it uninjured, and secondly, I really do want to get it under 6 days. That really was one of those targets, and it's not a definite, you know, there's no point setting yourself a challenge that you can definitely do. I still don't know I can definitely do it, but I think I can, so it's quite exciting. And I really want to, and I know, because I'm a bit different up here, that I'm probably glad that I didn't do it the first time, because I get to go and do it again. I might get divorced if I do it. Try, I have to do it for a third time.
Am I correct that Paul Tierney and Steve Birkinshaw came out to support you though?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah,
and yeah. It's just the way it's done. And yeah, as I would support anybody in a crack, because again, it's the enjoyment, isn't it, and the community feel to it. And yeah, they, you know, they definitely wanted me to succeed and were happy to help in whatever way, as much as it might have concerned Paul a little bit before I started crawling my way around. I think he might have been a bit concerned, but he's all right for a little while, but I'll have another crack. Obviously, it depends on the whole coronavirus situation, but I want to do it in May. I always wanted to do it in May. I think it's a good time of year to do it. July was a bit late and wet, and I had very flooded conditions. So I think just some decent ground conditions and weather conditions will help me massively. So, yeah, you need with these things, you need a lot to go right, as well as having the ability and training and knowledge and experience and wrecking the roots and a really good support team and blah, blah, blah. You also do need some small amount of luck with weather and ground conditions. Well, I do to help me with my 6 days, but we'll see.
And have you done the Bob Graham round itself then or not?
Yes, I've done the Bob one day a week after the Dragon's Back 1 year. It was a really nice day. And I left my house in Langdale and went up to Harrison Stickle. In fact, a friend of mine was at that time trying to do an under 15 hour Bob, which he completed. So I was just going to meet him on Harrison, run with him for whatever I could keep up, which I knew wouldn't be very much, and just send him on his merry way, which I did. And I'd packed my bag because I didn't know quite how far I'd get with him. Anyway, I got into Wasdale not too far behind him. And I thought, well, Wasdale's a real pig to get back to with a car, so I'm just going to keep running to Keswick. That's much more accessible. And then when I was at Keswick, I was like, oh, just be rude not to finish this now. But I went wrong. I did that, just a little solo thing off the cuff, which was good fun. And then I did a winter round, so I had an official, so I have actually got my BG certificate, because the one I did from my house doesn't count because it was unwitnessed and started in Langdale, didn't start at Moot Hall. Did go through Moot Hall, but I didn't start there. I did the winter one, I think three winters ago now, maybe. I actually got the record for that, for the winter one. Yeah. So
very good.
So that was good. Yeah. It was a good round.
So obviously you want to do the Wainwrights in under 6 days, but have you got any other future plans?
Oh, that's the major one. But I have a few race entries, you know, probably like most people. All our 2020 plans became 2021 plans. So Cape Wrath is a race I've been itching to do, and hoping maybe it will happen 2021, so that would be good. And other non-races, other challenges. Well, I just did the Coast to Coast. That was quite fun. Bobbed that in before we got locked down.
I could have done that with you on the bike.
Yeah, it's a good journey. It's a good journey. It was quite icy, and you might have been pushed off your bike a few times because it was during Storm Bella. That was quite dicey, I have to say. And then I did the Pennine Way in September. I don't know if I'll do that again, maybe. And the Ramsey's the other one. So everyone talks about the Bob Graham. And I went up to do the Ramsey some summer, really unplanned, more of a recce really, but it took me 26 hours to get round Ramsey's round. So I have to go back and do that one in under 24. And I've never had a go at the Paddy, but that would be another good one. I think that one's quite off-piste and technical from what I understand. So I'll have to go and have a look. But yeah, lots of them out there. And then I might just make one up. There's, in fact, a way called Sabrina Way.
Oh.
Yeah. And I came to it when I was fumbling around the Cotswolds some years ago. And I just saw this signpost, like a, you know, like a finger post that said Sabrina Way. And it's quite long. I think it's might be near 200 miles long. So I think that's a good one for me.
Oh, that sounds perfect.
Put my name on it.
Exactly. If there was one piece of equipment to have with you that you definitely needed, what would it be?
Got to have a waterproof.
A waterproof.
If there's one thing, if you've got to take one thing with you on the hill in the Lake District, it's got to be a waterproof. And mine is the Berghaus Hyper 100. It weighs 90 grams and it fits into it like, I don't know, a packet of tissues. It's so small that you would just be an idiot to ever leave home without it, because it is just this, like, and it's super waterproof. I've been caught out, like, I've gone out on a day that looks completely harmless, and I've been caught in this torrential thunderstorm with this tiny lightweight jacket and been bone dry after 2 hours of being bombarded by hail type. You know, when you've got these heavy water droplets and it's just this deluge and still been dry, that this is my one favourite ultimate piece of kit that I love to death. And I'd be very sad if they stop making that ever.
That's it. They've all gone off the rail now. Everybody will be buying them now. And my other question is, what do you wear on your feet? Our club members love trainers, and are always, there's always loads and loads of questions on trainers. And yeah. I know no, like, what fit me won't fit you and things like that, but what do you race in? What are your last, do you have separate ones for training and racing?
No,
as well,
no, only ever La Sportiva Mutants for everything: road running, trail running, fell running, long distance, short distance, everything. And I've been racing in them since that first ultra I did at Grand Tour of Skidder, because I won a pair of La Sportiva shoes and I bought, used my voucher to get a set of Mutants. Before that, I was using Salomon Speedcross. But once I tried the Mutants, I've just honestly just not looked back. And the reason is because it's got a lot of cushioning, a lot of room in the front of the shoe, so you don't get blisters. Well, I don't get blisters. And obviously the shoe has to fit you. So if you have feet that don't fit into a Mutant for every reason, they might not work for you. But majority of ultra runners, I think, are running in Mutants now, and they have not changed the Mutants for since I started using them. It must be like 6 years, and that's incredible because they keep trying to bring out new shoes. Even La Sportiva have sent me some stuff to try, and I'm like, these are great, but I prefer my Mutants. And I've done that like 4 or 5 times now, and I've tried other stuff and there's just nothing better than my Mutants. So I'm so happy with them. And then the other thing that I wear on my feet, which I thought you were talking about, was socks. And I do not understand why anyone would ever want to run with wet, muddy feet. So all I can say is you want a nice pair of waterproof socks to wear. Like, if you are ultra running and you are in your shoes and socks for 8, 9, 10 hours or days, you want dry feet. That will stop you getting blisters, because the waterproof socks stop mud getting in, as well as little stones and water, and so your feet will be much happier. And the ones I've found that work the best are the deck shells. And they brought out 2 this year, one of the ultra thin. So if you're not used to waterproof socks, get the ultra thin ones, because they feel like normal socks. The downside to them is they're not going to last for thousands of miles, because at some point you're going to breach the membrane. But they're pretty sturdy, and I have tested them through the worst, so they're good. And then they've got the compression mudder, which is thicker, and I wear it like when it's snowy and you've got ice water that you're putting your feet into. And then you just don't feel it. You like walking, you know, and they're knee high. They must be knee high. Don't go out and buy waterproof socks that only go to your ankle, because you're going to go in stuff that's over your ankle, and then there'll be swimming pools, and that'll be horrid because they won't let the water out. So you've got to have them up to your knee. They're just brilliant, because afterwards, when you get home, while I do training or race, whatever, and I take my socks off, and I've got lovely clean feet, dry, you know, because sometimes you're there scrubbing all the mud off, aren't you, when you've gone out with, yeah, but no, you've got lovely, clean, dry feet, no blisters. I just don't understand why anyone would ever run without waterproof socks on. I don't get it at all.
You see, when I do swim run, my feet are swimming in my trainers. So I can't have a waterproof sock. But what I was going to say was that the Sportivas that I race in for swim run help drain the water out very quickly from when you move from swim to run. So that's why I use them.
What about neoprene socks, though?
Yeah, you possibly could, but I suppose... It's trying to get that balance right between being on your feet and swimming. Obviously, they sometimes pool with water, so they have to be really, really tight. Definitely want to learn. I'll just learn to run without socks.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I've done running without socks in a sprint triathlon, so that's only 5K. I think that's the max I could do for now. I don't think I could do that, like, even 10K. I think it would just be too uncomfortable.
Is that save time on your transition?
Pretty much, yeah. And I just tried out on training sessions to see what it'd be like, and I thought I could get away with this for 5K. And yes, it saves me time, but I think for 10K, I think it's probably just worth just putting socks on. I think that's it, really.
Yeah, you definitely don't have time to sit down and dry your feet before you put your socks on after you've got water.
No.
Oh, I once did a sprint triathlon without a wetsuit on to save time, like with a shorty, like not even a shorty, but no, a tri-suit, that's what it was. Ah. Oh, my God. The worst idea ever. Oh, yeah, my transition was quick, but I could feel my feet until halfway through the run. A miserable experience. Try it at home. Not worth it. Just use the 3 minutes, whatever it takes, to get out your wetsuit. It's worth it.
I think we're at the end, aren't we? I think this has been brilliant having you on, Sabrina. Michelle, thank you for getting in contact with her and getting her on. So yeah, thank you to both of you for coming on as well.
We want to know how inspired they've been by this to go out and do an ultra.
Exactly. Please,
but
yeah.
But not the crazy way of just randomly choosing one and doing it, actually training and doing it. We'd love to hear about it.
Yes, we would. And shout out to Mark Wade, who's currently wrecking the Bob Graham round. If you're listening to this, which I'm sure you are, Mark, I'd be disappointed if you're not. Hopefully you've picked up a few tips from Sabrina. Thanks for listening, guys.